This is Unanimous Dissent, broadcasting from the Radio Sputnik studios in Washington, D.C. We are the District Sentinel. I'm Sam Sachs.
I'm Sam Knight. Coming up, most who worry about the future of the planet focus on the rising sea level these days. We have developments in another story with implications for global safety. We will duck into a classified session to cover it.
Nice one. Also, even though the political media and the candidates, mostly Trump, aren't interested in talking economic policy, we are. So we called Professor Richard Wolff to come on the show, and he agreed. He joins us later.
And stick around to the last block of the show when I explain the connection between an obscure French athlete and one of Washington, D.C.'s most prolific bloggers.
An obscure French athlete?
An obscure French athlete? I don't know. My mouth is kind of dry right now.
It's all good. But first, after going hundreds of days without giving a single press conference, Hillary Clinton has now made herself available to reporters for questions 2 days in a row.
Most transparent candidate in history,
it
y'all.
Is. There it is. You have it. What the hell is going on? Am I right? That's right. On Monday, she gave a press conference on her airplane. And then on Tuesday, Clinton gave another press conference light. She took questions for about 10 minutes from her traveling press corps all aboard her campaign plane. I say conference light because she spent most of the time delivering an opening statement on why Trump should release his tax returns. She should. And she spent another considerable amount of time in this press conference light answering just one question from reporters. She answered a few other questions, but the bulk of the press conference was in response to just one question from a reporter. And let me just read the question here from the reporter. I'd play you a clip of it, but this press conference light took place on an airplane and the sound quality is pretty bad and you can't really hear it. So here's the question. And this is, again, this is the question to Hillary Clinton, the person most likely to be the next president of the United States. And consider yourself as a reporter. Clinton has not given any, this is like the second press briefing she's given in hundreds of days. So you got to just be itching to ask a tough question here, ready to nail her, that adversarial journalism. But here was the question. Do you think that you are held to a different standard than Trump is by the media and voters? Basically a tee up question that Clinton spent the next 5 minutes asserting is true, that she is treated differently, a way to explain away the sort of bad news she's received in the last few weeks regarding her emails and the Clinton Foundation as just bad press, that the other candidates aren't held up to the same exact standards. And I don't know, to me, it just goes to show that press briefings, while valuable and necessary, can also be completely garbage if the press isn't willing to actually hold the candidates accountable.
I mean, this is one of the most astonishing things about Clinton's refusal to hold a press briefing for, what, 200 days or so, because this is what they're like.
Yeah, yeah. And just go to a typical White House press briefing. It's not much better either on a daily basis over there.
Yeah, it's also not hard to deflect.
Yes, it's very easy.
And reporters know that you're not going to talk about everything.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, you have these press briefings and you can expect more of them. You can expect Clinton, especially if these are the sort of questions she's going to get, told. They're easy for her.
Yeah.
Secretary Clinton, who's more evil, Donald Trump or King Joffrey from Game of Thrones? Can you elaborate on that for me? One quick follow-up, Madam Secretary. What's your favorite Katy Perry song? You get the idea. I will say, though, that this is an interesting development on the campaign trail. Just the fact that Clinton is even taking reporters' questions at this point.
Yeah.
Even if those questions are fit more for a fan club meeting than an adversarial press conference.
Secretary Clinton, I got a question. You know, you've been over this grueling campaign and we saw all the reportage at the start of the primary. And I just got to ask you, your Chipotle strategy, is it still the same or like what's up? How do you approach it? The salmonella scare at Chipotle, did it affect how you ordered Chipotle?
Oh, now you're getting into tougher territory here. Let's be careful. You'll be cut off at the first one there. Anyways, I'd venture a guess as to why the Clinton campaign is taking this new tack. And it might be in response to a tightening in presidential poll numbers. Despite the fact that Trump has done practically everything a candidate can do to try and lose the election at this point, I mean, fighting with Gold Star families, threatening to block an entire group of people from entering the U.S. based on their religion. You can go on. I mean, it's pretty clear that he's either trying to lose. In fact, it's been reported that he's trying to lose by Michael Moore, based on sources, or at least that he's running this campaign to boost his own. He doesn't really want to be the president. He's just trying to boost his own brand. We've reported extensively covered reports on how Trump is reimbursing himself very generously for campaign expenditures, you know, giving his hotel and golf courses and restaurants a lot of campaign cash. But yet, this race is still close. Clinton is still having trouble putting the Donald away. In fact, the nerds over at the polling site 538 issued a special election update this week to take note of the tightening poll numbers between Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump. And I'm reading from their special election update here. It says, quote, regarding the poll numbers, it's been toward Trump over the past few weeks. Clinton's lead peaked at about 8.5 percentage points in early August, according to our models, and Trump has since sliced that figure roughly in half. Of Trump's roughly 4-point gain since then, about 2 points came from Trump's having gained ground, while the other 2 points come from Clinton's having lost ground, possibly a sign that her lofty numbers in early August were inflated by a convention bounce. It could also be a sign that Clinton is just mismanaging her campaign or employing a very bad campaign strategy. Now, one of the criticisms during the Democratic primary between Clinton and Sanders was that Clinton's just not good at campaigning. Just look at 2008. She did not run a very good campaign there. I mean, you got to hand it to Barack Obama, who ran an excellent campaign, but she was the clear favorite heading into 2008. She had most of the establishment on her side, and she still lost. And then look at 2016. Give Bernie credit. He also ran a hell of a campaign. He revolutionized how candidates can raise money without super PACs. He, you know, articulated issues that segments of the voting electorate, segments of the electorate have been ignored for too long. But Clinton had the entire Democratic establishment on her side. She had a 500-plus superdelegate lead, fundraising advantage, the DNC, all of this on her side, and yet she couldn't put Bernie away until the very end, simply because she doesn't know how to campaign well, or at least hire people who know how to run effective campaigns.
Yeah, really quickly, I just can't help but feel, and, you know, this is in no way meant to be morbid or, you know, take the issue lightly, but if Joe Biden's son didn't die, I can see him running and being the nominee right now very easily.
And I would see him probably having a much larger lead. I don't know what his campaign strategy would be, and if it would mirror what we've seen Clinton do over the last 4 weeks. Maybe it would, but...
Or, as my fever dreams around the Michigan primary tell me, had Biden entered the race, he and Clinton could have split the centrist vote, thus opening a path for Bernard Sanders to the nomination.
That's true. And I obviously don't want to, before we get attacked on Twitter or something, I don't want to downgrade the role that sexism does play in all of this.
Sure.
Clearly, Clinton does have some negative numbers because she is a woman. I'm not going to deny that that animates a lot of voter sentiments. But let's remember, there's a lot of racism in voter sentiments that President Obama running an extremely effective campaign against a strong politician like John McCain was able to get rid of, was able to overcome. Here's Clinton running against a disaster of a candidate,
yeah,
in Donald Trump, and she seems to be struggling here. And this has always been a knock on her. And as evidence of it, polls during the primary showed that in a hypothetical matchup, between Sanders and Trump and Clinton and Trump, Sanders outperformed her every single time. But Democrats went ahead. They chose the weaker candidate, Hillary Clinton, and now they're living with those consequences, frankly. Remember, this was an election that just a month ago, after the conventions, looked like Clinton couldn't possibly lose, and Democrats were assured to take the Senate. In 4 weeks, though, a lot has changed. It's now a coin flip whether or not Democrats will take the Senate, and Clinton's lead continues to shrink, and I'd argue it's because of what we already know. The Democratic nominee for president is running a bad campaign, and just consider what she's done over the last few weeks, some of which we've already talked about on this show, but it's worth repeating. Spending multiple speeches rehabilitating the GOP, talking about good Republicans, people like George W. Bush and Bob Dole and John McCain, essentially giving cover to down ballot Republicans and hurting down ballot Democrats, saying Trump isn't like the GOP. Trump's different than the GOP. So it's okay if you want to support your down ballot Republicans, rather than doing what the DNC advised, which was try and tie Trump to down ballot Republicans. You know, this is very much an anti-establishment election. Bernie Sanders performed very well because he was an anti-establishment figure. Donald Trump won the nomination because he's perceived as an anti-establishment figure. Whether or not he's actually is up for debate. I'd say he's not, but at least he's able to play that part very well. And yet Clinton doesn't seem to understand that. Rather than trying to touch the disaffected electorate that feels left out, that is driving this election, the angry vote, she's clinging to the establishment. She's reaching out to GOP neocons, to billionaire donors, to establishment figures like John Podesta to head her campaign, establishment politicians like Tim Kaine to be her VP. Establishment political operatives like Ken Salazar to lead her transition team. Again, this is an anti-establishment election, and she's hugging the establishment as hard as she can. Not to mention that her messaging on Donald Trump is all over the place. We've talked about all the reporting that can be used against Trump, from the countless number of small business Americans who he's bilked, who he's refused to pay for services. The USA Today did lots of reporting on that, to how he's blatantly violating FEC laws, how he's enriching his own campaign, all this stuff. And yet, instead, we're getting messaging from the Clinton campaign that Trump is a dangerous Kremlin candidate. Either that, or he's an oaf who has no idea what he's talking about. One of those two, by the way, they can't both be true.
Dangerous Donald.
Right. So, look, there's plenty of things that I would point to explain the shifting poll numbers the past few weeks. And although any one of them does make me want to say, I told you so a million times to Clinton supporters that I fought with during the primary, I won't say that because none of this makes me happy. I don't want to see a Trump presidency any more than the next reasonable, sane person does. And I feel as though the Democratic nominee for president is increasing those possibilities by running a bad campaign and trying to bring aboard the seediest members of the DC establishment into her coalition rather than the millions of working people who were inspired by Bernie Sanders and just want someone, some politician somewhere to acknowledge them. And really, I blame Clinton's surrogates and supporters for running cover for their candidate right now, rather than calling out this bankrupt strategy for what it is, which is failing.
What I just like to say really quickly, what's really embarrassing is these neocons that she's rehabilitating. They were largely discredited in 2008 when Clinton lost the Democratic primary because she was seen as being too close to that sort of regime change ideology.
Yeah, and as much as Clinton would like to make herself out to be an extension of President Obama, that to a lot of Democrats, to the Democratic base, President Obama has been an incredibly successful president that a lot of people are very, very proud of. You ask someone on the far left, they'll have, other things to say about that. But if you look at the Democratic Party, they like Obama. So if you're running under that ticket, you want to attach yourself to President Obama. But there's a big difference between Clinton and Obama. Although people on the left and would say that Obama's been a warmonger as well, expanding the drone war. Neocons have not supported him, have spent the last years, 8 years, criticizing his policies. So Obama doesn't have the neocons on his side. They don't approve of what he's doing. But they do approve, or would approve, or gather that they would approve of what Hillary Clinton would do as president. And that should be a bit troubling. As you said, Clinton voted for the Iraq War, which is one of the reasons she lost the primary to Barack Obama. And that kicked the neocons out into the wilderness, the political wilderness, after they had been in power under George W. Bush. And now they see an opening here by supporting Hillary Clinton, that they could get back into power.
Yeah, it wasn't just Iraq either. I remember during the primary, Clinton made comments about Iran, sort of flippant remarks about, you know, sort of how we could threaten and browbeat them and actually bomb them, you know, if we needed to on behalf of Israel and all that they claim about Iran's nuclear program. And then, of course, John McCain famously took a hit for singing his bomb, 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 bomb Iran thing. And both of these people lost to Obama.
Yeah. We're just, you know, the neocons won in 2000. They won in 2004. They lost in 08 and they lost in 12. And they're looking to win again in 2016 with Hillary Clinton. More unanimous dissent coming up. And welcome back to Unanimous Dissent, where the two Sams are still broadcasting from Washington, D.C. Just a reminder, you can read all of our Watchdog News reporting over at our website, www.districtsentinel.com. Now, observers of the 2016 election may have noticed that it has very little, the actual debate going on right now has very little to do with economic policies. Sure, both candidates have put forward proposals on how they would manage the U.S. economy. I say both candidates, I mean mostly Hillary Clinton. Trump has put forward a plan, but it basically cribs the entire House GOP economic plan, stuff like tax cuts for the rich, repealing all regulations, getting rid of the estate tax. But nobody's really talking about this stuff because, hey, whatever Trump says on whatever day immediately dominates the news, and Trump says very little bit about economic policy in general. Sure, he talks about trade, but he tends not to get into the specifics. But that's not going to stop us from talking about it. And here to help us do that is Professor Richard Wolff. He's a former professor of economics emeritus at UMass Amherst, currently visiting professor at New School New York in New York City. He's the founder of Democracy at Work and host of the weekly radio show Economic Update. Hi, Professor Wolff. Thanks for coming on the show.
My pleasure. Thanks for inviting me.
Glad to have you on. So our latest jobs report about a week ago came out showing that payroll employment increased by 151,000 jobs in August. The unemployment rate remained at 4.9%, a reasonably low number. This is all numbers from the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics. What's your analysis, though, on the current state of the U.S. economy in this election year that we're in?
Well, I'd say the words that would come to my mind are tragic, and on bad days, catastrophic. We are basically in a long-term slump. It's called secular stagnation in economics. But whatever language you use, the basic story is this. Global capitalism, including America, collapsed in 2008. Most economists didn't foresee it. Most politicians couldn't imagine it. And so not only did we get hit with a tremendous collapse, the second worst in capitalism's history, beaten out only by the Great Depression of the 1930s, but we were unprepared intellectually, politically, policy-wise. So the end result has been, here we are 8 years later, and we are still in the funk, in the economic depression, recession, downturn, lame recovery. There are countless phrases for it, but it is really a tragedy. It is now basically a lost decade of American economic life. It has produced on the left Bernie Sanders, on the right Donald Trump. Mrs. Clinton tries to pretend as though everything is kind of working out okay, so that she shouldn't vote for the people on the left who are terribly upset, or the people on the right who are terribly upset. You should stay with her. This is a difficult game to play, given that the old establishment that she is part of and represents were the people who brought us this disaster in the first place. So for me, as an economist, a professional economist looking at it, again, I would say it's a tragedy made worse by the game of not confronting it that the two major candidates basically play.
Well, on that point, given this reality that you put forward, that at least Hillary Clinton and the Obama coalition aren't recognizing, to them, the economy is growing stronger and getting better. You see the Republican candidate, Donald Trump, actually articulating this idea that there is something deeply wrong with the economy. Whether or not he fully understands what that is remains to be seen. But at least the both candidates on the campaign trail have put forward economic proposals. But are anything that you've seen put forward? I mean, Hillary Clinton's proposing a surtax on the wealthy, a small surtax on the wealthy, raising some marginal income tax rates on the wealthy. Trump's proposing repealing the estate tax, things like that. Are any of these proposals, and I guess I'm just focusing on Clinton's, what needs to be done to address these deep structural problems within our economy? And if not, why is the debate so narrow in terms of the solutions to this economic problem you talk about?
Well, let me answer as bluntly as I know how. I don't think either candidate is making anything remotely like a serious effort to recognize, let alone propose, solutions for the basic economic problems. Yes, Trump, as an outsider, is saying things aren't good, vote for me, I'll make them better. He's doing for the economy exactly what Obama did to George Bush 8 years ago. And Mrs. Clinton, because she's so wrapped up with the Obama administration, has to pretend it's all okay. As to the few things they propose, let me put it this way. The most important agency that studies inequality in the world, economic inequality, is an outfit in Great Britain called Oxfam, O-X-F-A-M. Anyone interested can just Google it and you'll learn all about them. Been around for decades. They issue a report every year on global inequality, and they did one this year, 2016, as well. Here is the major takeaway statistic that their report showed. The 62 richest people in the world, most of whom, by the way, are Americans, not all, but most, the 62 richest people in the world together have more wealth than the bottom half of the population of the planet Earth, roughly 3.5 billion people. Mm. Okay, that is a fundamental problem, to have 62 individuals, and we know their names, Warren Buffett, Gates, all of that. 62 people together control more wealth than the bottom half of the population. The bottom half, the 3.5 billion, those are the people who die at an early age, have every conceivable disease that could and would be solved if wealth were distributed differently. So if you want to deal with the problems of the world, you have to deal with that fundamental inequality. The little proposals of adjusting tax rates that Mrs. Clinton proposes are so inadequate to the scale of the problem that you kind of have to catch your breath at the sheer effrontery of proposing something so small for a problem so big. And when Mr. Trump suggests getting rid of the estate tax, which is already a minuscule effort to do something about that horrible inequality, and therefore if he gets elected and does it, it'll only get worse. That's an example for me of being confronted with monumental problems that are clearly outlined and deciding to pretend that there's nothing important there that can't either be ignored or dealt with by the kind of minuscule mini steps that couldn't in a million years make a dent on a problem of this size.
Professor Wolf, I want to move away briefly from the candidates and Capitol Hill and talk a little bit about the Federal Reserve. They just recently had a policy getaway in Jackson Hole, Wyoming, where they've repeated something that Fed officials and other central bank officials around the world have said repeatedly, which is they feel that they can't do any more for the economy in the short term with interest rates near zero. And I just sort of wanted to ask you, you know, what you make of that and what role do you see the Federal Reserve sort of playing in, you know, the overall state of the economy being the way it is in secular stagnation?
Well, basically, the job of the Federal Reserve is to manage the money supply of the United States, something which is done in other countries by something called, in most of them, the central bank, such as the Bank of England or the Bank of France or the Bank of Japan. We have a funny history, so we don't call it the Bank of the United States. We call it the Federal Reserve, but it controls the quantity of money in circulation, or at least a major part of it. It has a great deal of influence on interest rates and so on. When the great crash happened in 2008, the Federal Reserve quickly embarked on an unprecedented, historically never before tried series of steps to flood the economy with money, which it did, and to drop interest rates not only to zero, but as we have seen over the last year, to minus, to negative interest rates, something the world hasn't seen for a very long time, and then only sporadically here and there. So they've done all they can do, and so they are now announcing that in the light of these unprecedented moves, to have as poor a recovery as we have, no recovery at all in Europe and Japan, and the recovery here really misnamed because it only affects the top 10% of the American economy. The other 90% is in deep trouble. The Federal Reserve is simply saying what everybody knows, which is we've done all we are allowed and legally entitled to do. It isn't working. It isn't solving the problem. It isn't making the economies of the world better again, anything like they were even as recently as 2007. And so we want other people to step up to the plate. And basically what they mean by that is they want governments around the world to do deficit spending, to spend money like crazy on things like infrastructure, rebuilding roads and bridges and harbors, and to boost the economy in that way. What you're really seeing here is that capitalism as a system is in terribly great difficulty, and the conventional monetary and fiscal tools are coming too little, too late to the party.
Just briefly, I want, and maybe this is my own ignorance here, but I always sort of, you know, when looking at the quantitative easing program, which is the flooding of money into financial markets that you're talking about, I can't help but think that the Fed maybe could have done more on municipal markets and public borrowing, and maybe not so much on the commercial markets. But I don't know. I might be mistaken there.
Not at all. I mean, you know, think of it in a very simple way. Don't get lost in the weeds or the details of all of this. The Federal Reserve has a simple project. The idea is if you pump a lot of money into the economy, well, then people having easier, quicker access to money will go after that money, and then they will go and use the money to buy things, and that will give people jobs making those things, and the economy will get kickstarted and resume. It's a basically simple idea, but the minute you put it into effect, you have to answer a very important question. To whom is the Federal Reserve going to give all of this extra money that it can and does create literally out of thin air? And the answer in our system is it gives it primarily to the banks and secondarily to large corporations. It doesn't have to do that. That's its policy. It used to be called by a good name called trickle-down economics, because if you give the money to big banks and corporations, you're clearly giving it to the top of the economic pyramid, and you're hoping, in a sense, that they will go out there and lend the money and spend the money, and it'll trickle down to everyone's benefit. There is, of course, and here's where you're quite right, an alternative. Instead of trickle down, you might have a philosophy and a policy that could be called trickle up. Give the money that you're producing to the people at the bottom, to the mass of the working class, to the poor. Let them go out, because you're very confident, and you can be, that if you give those folks a lot of money, they will indeed spend it, since that's what they do with whatever money they usually get. And then they would buy goods and services, and that would put people back to work, et cetera, et cetera. You could, in fact, distribute money into the economy in different ways, and it might have worked much better to have pumped up the bottom in the hopes that it'll trickle up, rather than to pursue the policy they stick to come hell or high water, which is to help the top, the very people that brought us the crisis, in the hope that it'll trickle down. And here we are 8 years, it didn't trickle.
To advance this sort of trickle-up economics, one policy that could be embraced is universal basic income, essentially guaranteeing a certain wage for everybody just for being alive in the country every year. It's been an idea that's floated by labor leader Jeremy Corbyn. Finland is experimenting with a universal basic income. Bernie Sanders injected some radical ideas into the primary, radical at least by U.S. standards, not radical by the rest of the world, things like a single-payer healthcare system, free college. He wasn't able to bring into it a universal basic income, which seems like a sort of non-starter a lot in U.S. politics. Do you envision a time in which our country would be more open to radical economic ideas like a universal basic income? And is that something that's worth pursuing? We've got just about a minute and a half, Professor.
Yes, I absolutely think, as the failure both of this economic system and of the conventional policies designed to cope with it, as that proliferates and worsens, all kinds of things, like the very quantitative easing 2 and 3 we've had, like the negative interest rates, guaranteed income is something that will be considered. But let me correct you on one point. We've already done that. In the midst of the Great Depression of the 1930s, Roosevelt, 1933, 4, and 5, created the Social Security system. That basically said to every human being who was a citizen of America, once you reach age 65, we're going to give you a guaranteed basic income. That's what Social Security is to every single person. It was a way of producing trickle-up economics, as was his creation of the unemployment compensation system, etc. The only reason Bernie Sanders' modest proposals were non-starters, as you put it, was because we have very carefully undone the awareness of our own American economic history in the population precisely to make it harder and harder for those kinds of more progressive policies to get the airing and the debate that they are long overdue and that we as a people badly need.
Very well said. Professor Wolf, Richard Wolf, visiting professor at New School in New York, founder of Democracy at Work, hosts the weekly radio show Economic Update. Where can people listen to that real quick?
It's on 71 stations around the country. Just go to democracyatwork.info and on the web, all one word, democracyatwork.info. And you can find out every program, past and present, where it's played and everything else.
There you go. And you can follow Professor Wolf on Twitter at Prof Wolf with 2 F's, no E. Thanks so much for coming on.
My pleasure. Thanks for inviting me.
Thank you, Professor.
More unanimous dissent coming up. Unanimous Dissent still here with you, still broadcasting out of the Radio Sputnik studios in Washington, D.C. I'm Sam Sachs.
I'm Sam Knight.
We're the District Sentinel news team, and you can read all of our latest reports over at www.districtsentinel.com. All right. Can I get a little beat? Can I get a little, I'm thinking Eminem here.
Okay.
Guess who's back?
Bum, bum, back.
Again. Congress is back. Tell a friend.
I'm glad I didn't do a beat for that.
Great. You made it way worse for me. Anyways, Congress is back, folks. After quite a long hiatus, 7 weeks they were on vacation, the longest summer recess in modern history, in fact. But don't overwork our precious lawmakers. They have another vacation they have to get to at the end of the month. After 7 weeks off and now about 3 or 4 weeks back in session, Congress will take another vacation starting next month and remain off until after the election, until a lame duck session kicks off. So really, you can't expect these lawmakers to get much done. There is, however, one major thing they do need to get done, something that is so basic and yet oh so difficult for them, keeping the government funded. September 30th, the last day that Congress is supposed to be in session this month and until after the election is over, September 30th is when the current fiscal year ends and when the government runs out of money unless Congress appropriates more money for it, a process that over the past several years has been fraught with dysfunction. In fact, you might remember in 2013, Republicans and Democrats just blew past the government funding deadline, mainly because senators like Ted Cruz believed that a government shutdown over defunding Obamacare would be good for his presidential hopes. We know now that didn't work out, and in the end, the government did shut down in 2013 for 15 days, furloughing workers, closing national parks, halting certain government services, and ultimately sucking billions of dollars out of the U.S. economy. Well, Congress is going to try to avoid all of that again, and it has about 3.5 weeks to do it, starting right now. By the way, if you think Donald Trump's answers to various policy debate questions of the day have been incoherent or uninformed, I really can't wait until there's a government shutdown debate in the news and hearing Trump trying to walk that thin line of what should happen. You know, we know that maneuvering those political considerations have cost much better Republicans their jobs. Looking at you, John Boehner. I'm guessing what's most likely to happen over the next few weeks is a lot of political jockeying on both sides, threats by Republicans that they'll shut it down, Democrats countering that they need to act like reasonable lawmakers and do their one basic job of keeping the lights on. And then when the deadline arrives, September 30th, we'll get some short-term spending bill that will basically kick the can to the lame duck session or until the next Congress is sworn in sometime next year or in January. So the problem will be averted for just a few months. Or not, or maybe Congress will screw things up and we might have another government shutdown. I wouldn't be surprised either way at this point. There is some other legislation, though, that Congress will more than likely leave on the burner because they have to go on vacation and all. TPP, that's actually good that they won't be getting around to that. McConnell, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell has already stated there'll be no lame duck session vote on the sweeping trade deal. Criminal justice reform, which is kind of a bummer, but also good since the legislation has grown rotten anyway, as Republicans have tried to use it as a vehicle to pass corporate crime reform, letting white-collar folks off the hook easier. Let's see, no confirmation of Merrick Garland, likely no tax reform, two other policies that might actually be good for the left if they're left to languish. There's also the National Defense Authorization Act, which can't be left on the burner. That's must-pass legislation that programs the U.S. war machine. Already there are disagreements arising between the White House and Congress, as well as within Congress. The House and Senate disagree over whether the total U.S. military force size should slightly increase or slightly decrease from its 2015 levels. So there's a lot of work to do in this session of Congress. Not much time to do it, again, because of all the vacation that needs to be had. By the way, here was Minority Leader Harry Reid speaking on the floor of the Senate Tuesday, saying Democrats are opposed to the long-term congressional vacations imposed by the GOP.
We just completed 7 weeks of doing nothing, none of our country's essential business, and now Republicans are suggesting another 10 weeks of vacation. But Speaker Ryan and Senator McConnell should understand that Democrats will not support 10 more weeks away from Washington. We have a lot of work to do. We cannot ignore the nation's work.
Bad news for you, Mr. Leader. You don't set the calendar. Don't have much say in the matter. So enjoy your vacation.
Speaking of calendar, later this month, the world will mark the 16th anniversary of Frederick Weiss entering the global discourse. Yeah, well,
name might ring a bell here.
Well, if you don't know who Weiss is, that's okay. I'm sure you're not alone. Weiss was in the year 2000, the center on the French Olympic basketball team. And on September 25th, 2000, American power forward Vince Carter dunked on Weiss by quite literally jumping over him. Carter jumped over Weiss's entire 7'2" frame.
Oh yeah, it was an epic dunk made into tons of posters.
Exactly, exactly. And also GIFs. And in fact, the GIF has been used in countless social media interactions after someone gets put in their place for saying something that most observers would consider unintelligent. In other words, a total dunking.
Probably like my favorite dynamic among social media interactions.
Yeah, when someone posts something dumb and then you look at the responses and you scroll down and there are just
like, oh my God, you were owned so hard.
GIF after GIF. Sometimes it's stills of a guy breaking the backboard, you know, dunking with the entire glass shattering.
Yeah.
Anyway, so I think you know where this is going. On Tuesday, the image of Weiss came to the minds of many on Twitter after Vox's Matthew Iglesias tried to defend Hillary Clinton by writing a blog post called, quote, "Against Transparency." Now, in the post, Iglesias argued that Clinton's emails should not be subject to public disclosure in the way that they have since, well, I'm not really sure why, since recordings of government phone calls, allegedly, Iglesias writes, aren't subject to FOIA.
Yeah, I'm not sure.
I will read briefly from the post. The issue is that while common sense sees email and phone calls as close substitutes, Iglesias wrote, federal transparency law views them very differently. The relevant laws were written decades ago in an era when the dichotomy between written words, memos and letters, and spoken words, phone calls and meetings, was much starker than it is today. He also wrote the following, treating email as public by default rather than private like phone calls does not serve the public interest. We need to let public officials talk to each other and to their professional contacts outside the government in ways that are both honest and technologically modern.
I wasn't aware that the government officials aren't able to talk to each other.
Well, I mean, I, for one, thank Matt, because who, if he won't spit hot balls of truth to help out the Clinton campaign and also more generally those downtrodden political appointees over at the State Department. So thank you, Matt.
Yes, I'm sure I could find a few other people who do it too.
True.
Paging Bob Chesky.
He's not the only one either. But yeah, I mean, it's basically Iglesias is the archetype though, isn't he? Well, unfortunately for this amazing post, it does not contain the word exemption once. FOIA statute contains a few exemptions, and there is a big fat one that will, quote, let public officials talk to each other, and that's exemption B5. In fact, it's even called the deliberative process exemption. So Iglesias wouldn't have needed to read past the mere title of that exemption to know that FOIA already allows for what he's talking about, the allowance of internal discussion or deliberative process, which of course brings us back to Frederick Weiss. Shortly after this was published Tuesday morning by Vox, Matt did his best Weiss impression when he shared the story on Twitter and was dunked on by just about everyone, really.
Yeah.
It particularly went poorly when investigative journalists, reporters, and media professionals interested in uncovering actual news replied. And I will just bring up three examples here.
The three dunkings of Matt Iglesias.
Steve Riley, a muckraker from USA Today, who tweets at by Steve Riley, chimed in, for example, in a series of tweets. Steve said, if records of the phone calls are created, they are subject to disclosure under FOIA. And again, your premise that FOIA views phone and email records, quote, very differently is misguided. Can you cite the part of FOIA that distinguishes between the two? And then he, of course, linked to the text of the Freedom of Information Act. So here's Matt Iglesias' reply. I really think my point about this is very clear. Steve's response. I'm not saying your understanding of FOIA is unclear. I'm saying it's incorrect.
Booyah!
Yeah, slam-a-jamma. I don't know, that just reminds me, very Clyde Drexler-like of Steve Riley there. Clyde the Glide. So moving on, then it was the Associated Press editor Ted Bridas getting his digs in on Iglesias with a very short and sweet dunk he just tweeted a link to Iglesias's article at him and added the following. When AP got FAA phone transcripts of police inventing reasons to bar news helicopters flying over Ferguson. So yes, this, these phone transcripts that, Matt Iglesias should think always should be exempt from disclosure, from transparency requirements.
Often reveal very newsworthy things.
Yeah. Yeah. So I believe Maddie, the term is posterized again. And finally, none other than Jason Leopold dunked on Matt. Jason is a man who has used the Freedom of Information Act to produce so much journalism. He was once jokingly called a, quote, FOIA terrorist by federal officials. Here are Jason's tweets. Horrible Vox article written by person who never used FOIA, doesn't understand how it works, and has never heard of B5. Here's an email link about, quote, frank discussions about Guantanamo from HRC cash that at Matt Iglesias argues could be damaging. And there's a photo that accompanies this post by Jason, and I'll just describe it since you can't see it. It's an entire page of redactions under B5, the deliberative process exemption. At Matt Iglesias, that exemption to the right, B5, is used and abused to protect every, quote, frank discussion in your 5 bullet points. So, Matt, sorry you were dunked on again, this time by the FOIA terrorist. Anyway, there's a lesson in all of this, kids, all you youngsters out there with dreams of one day being a journalist. First of all, don't be a journalist. Second of all, be sure to actually fact check before posting. Or rather, don't, I suppose, if you want to end up with a 6-figure salary that will pay you to explain the news that's fit to post without much oversight. You will, however, still be subjected to dunks. You will very much be subjected to getting dunked on Twitter.com. A Vox salary cannot save you from that. So be careful unless you want to be compared online to Frederick Weiss, the 7'2" Frenchman whose entire body was dunked on famously by Vincent Carter.
Yeah, can our kids just going to hang posters now of Matt Iglesias in their room? By the way, I wonder how many times Iglesias complained about FOIA laws before the candidate of his choice was accused of violating FOIA laws. My guess, 0.
Perhaps. I mean, had he done, he might have known how widely B5 is used.
Yeah.
Because I filed a FOIA based on something in a Senate investigative report with Department of Homeland Security. And
yeah.
I just got all B5, like entire pages of redactions.
Yeah. I just want to comment here, and you and I run the District Sentinel. It's just a 2-man operation.
Yeah.
We have a few other people that work with us on occasion.
Yeah.
Nothing goes on that website without us both like looking over it and thinking about it.
Yeah. That is,
what is the operation over at Vox where Matt Iglesias can publish this article that is so completely wrong, and yet no one over there is like, hey, Matt, maybe this isn't your best work here. By the way, have you heard of B5 exemptions? Matt, maybe we'll just kind of spike this article.
Yeah, maybe your article should at least mention the word exemption.
Yeah. Like, how does that happen? I mean, this was, I guess I can answer how that happens. No one reads anything and people can just publish whatever they want to it, which is how, what was that story a few years ago that thought there was a highway connecting
Gaza and the West Bank. That was right. That was during the Israeli bombing of Gaza. And one of Vox's guys, the foreign policy guy, Zach Beauchamp, said that there was a bridge connecting the Gaza Strip and the West Bank, which I'm sure was welcome news to the Palestinians living under Israeli occupation.
Just think about the stuff you guys are publishing.
You gotta stack them clicks, fam.
Yeah. And moving on, let's reconvene for this next story in a classified session.
We need to get into classified session.
Thank you very much, Secretary Kerry, for securing the studio. You are, after all, a main figure in this story. And what bigger story is there than the fate of the planet? Since the dawn of the atomic age, humanity has been frightened to death of... well, humanity, and the possibility of a nuclear war ending life on this planet as we, humanity, know it.
Cockroaches be chilling, though.
Indeed, they will. Anyway, we received a development on this story on Monday, the concepts governing nuclear war. is what the report was on. And it was courtesy of some insider New York Times journalism, the good kind that actually breaks news. On Tuesday, the Times said that the Obama administration will not be abandoning the first strike nuclear doctrine. The president had considered giving it up after enduring criticism from analysts, including former senior staffers, over unfulfilled promises made earlier in his presidency and during his 2008 campaign. In 2009, for example, during a speech in Prague, Obama promised to work towards, quote, a world without nuclear weapons. But by 2010, he had agreed to modernize America's nuclear arsenal as the START treaty with Russia was renewed, and he came under pressure from congressional Republicans who particularly wanted to make the trillion-dollar decades-long investment. It was this year, in 2016, that Obama, after his visit to Hiroshima, for obvious reasons, started to consider policies that would make good on the promise to work toward a world without nuclear weapons. But he was dissuaded by cabinet members from abandoning the first strike doctrine. Those who dissuaded him included Secretary of State John Kerry, Secretary of Defense Ash Carter, and Secretary of Energy Ernest Moniz. Kerry and Carter, quote, expressed concern that new moves by Russia and China from the Baltic to the South China Sea made it the wrong time to issue the declaration. The Times noted that a public eschewing would have been mostly superficial because almost every U.S. president, quote, since Harry S. Truman, has made it clear that nuclear weapons would be only used as a last resort. Now that, however, is called into disrepute by military history. President Truman, of course, ordered two nukes to be used against an already decimated Japan in 1945. And yeah. This came reportedly came amid skepticism that the bombings were necessary to force surrender, although there are a lot of officers who questioned the decision, including Dwight Eisenhower, Chester Nimitz, and William Leahy. And the first two are more well-known. Leahy was Truman's Secretary of State.
We're out of time. We can't do any more on the story. We've got so much we could do on the story, but we're fresh out of time. We'll save it for tomorrow's show. Thanks for listening. That'll do it for Unanimous Dissent today. Listen to all our shows by going to our website at www.districtsentinel.com. Subscribe on iTunes by searching for District Sentinel Radio. And stick around for tomorrow's show. We're not going anywhere. We'll stay here in D.C. so you don't have to be.